there was no preconceived ideas or this is too hard or too difficult. It was like watching or experiencing a modern or abstract painting and just accepting it and having and letting it flow around me and through me.
That was actress, producer, and leading interpreter of Molly Bloom, Aideen Maloney. And I'm John Lee.
And I'm Martin Nutty. And welcome to another episode of Irish Stew, the podcast for the global Irish nation.
Today's episode of Irish Stew is sponsored by Oum Art, where you can find original prints, jewelry, home decor, and custom gifts featuring Oum, the first written form of the Irish language. Visit oumart.com, and that's OHAMART.com. And listeners can save 20% at oumart.com using coupon code IrishStew. That's OHAMART.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Martin Nutty, and you're listening to the Irish Stew podcast. Talk for the global Irish nation. I'm joined here by my colleague, John Lee. John, how are you?
Hello, Martin. Well, today we're joined by global Irish citizen Aideen Maloney. She's an accomplished actress on the stages of Dublin, London, New York, and elsewhere, on TV, in film, an award-winning theatrical producer, a voiceover artist. Martin, I've known Aideen for years, and you met her last week. So please join me in welcoming Aideen Maloney to Irish Stew. Welcome.
Hey, Aideen.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here. Absolutely delighted.
Well, Aideen, let's go back to where you and Martin met a week ago in the Studio Theater at the Irish Repertory Theater, where you had just performed, yes, Reflections of Molly Bloom. It was adapted from the final segment of James Joyce's Ulysses by you and Colm McCann, the great writer, directed by John Keating, and with music from the legendary Patty Maloney. Aideen, when you were out on stage inhabiting Molly's mind all alone for 90 minutes, I'm going to guess you were alone when you first read Ulysses at the amazing age of 10, when most kids that age might be reading something like Mr. Popper's Penguins. Is that a 10-year-old Aideen up there on stage with you, keeping you company? And yes.
I guess so. You know, I don't think we ever really lose who we are and our foundations. And I still think I'm a child. Certainly, I still think I'm in my late 20s, early 30s, and I'm probably delusional, but I still feel that way. And when I speak to my mother and I pass time with my mother, I see and hear a girl just as much as I do a woman of a certain age. And I'd like to think the same of all women and probably all men too. You know, I don't think we ever lose the child within us, and we might hide them away, but they're still with us. So I guess I do. I still have all the vulnerabilities and insecurities and fears that a child might have. But I think as an actress and as an adult, I think we have more fear and more insecurities. Life has kind of taught us those.
Well, I know a lot of people have fear of Ulysses at this age. Martin's probably farther ahead in the process than I am, but it's certainly a daunting task. But you tackled it at a very young age.
I did. I mean, it was purely by accident, quite honestly. I'd never heard of James Joyce or Ulysses or had any care about anything to do with Joyce or his work or his life. I never heard of him. And I grew up in a household with, for most of my childhood, we had no television. So my father, a musician, was out on the road a great deal. And my mom was an avid reader and instilled that love of literature and books into my brothers and myself. So, you know, I used to come home from school and I had a habit of reading out loud, everything out loud, to entertain myself. And the characters that were in books, came to life for me. And I guess that's where I got the sense of the, you know, drama, you know, the dramatic from, and hearing my own voice, but also hearing and seeing these characters come to life off the pages, not just in my mind, but all around me. And I loved the rhythm and music of different writers' voices. And each writer, when you read their work aloud, it has its own personality. You can hear the personality of the person and, you know, their rhythms and their way of thinking. And so I enjoyed that. I mean, I loved music. Obviously, I'm not my father's daughter for nothing. So I read it, and it all came to life for me. And I had a very open mind, and I think children do have open minds and open hearts and are less questioning what is this all about. They have some, they have a reaction, they have something, even on a visceral level, as to what something means or what it means to them. And they're thinking minds, and there was no fear of the book. There was no preconceived ideas or this is too hard or too difficult. It was like watching or experiencing a modern or abstract painting and just accepting it and having and letting it flow around me and through me. So that was one observation I had. A second observation as a child is I recognized some of the characters, and I said, I know some of these degenerates. You know, being a native Dubliner myself and growing up in an environment where I was exposed to lots of very interesting characters, not only through the arts, but just Dublin characters, and their music and what they were saying seemed familiar to me. A third observation that I had was that I loved the fact that Joyce was breaking all the rules with grammar and being educated by the Sisters of Charity at St. Anne's in Milltown, where it was grammar and how it's learned was being hammered into me. I was a 10-year-old and I was on the cusp of being a teenager. So obviously there's a slight little bit of rebellion in there, and I enjoyed that with him. And I just enjoyed it. I really did. I enjoyed it. That's not to say I understood everything, nor did I try to. I let it speak to me instead of me trying to muscle it in my head. So that was my experience.
Well, fortunately, we have another Dublin character here on the show, Martin Nutty, and maybe you two could compare notes about your hometown.
Yeah, we like to kind of roll back the clock to get a sense of your origin story. And of course, you mentioned your dad, just for listeners that might not know, Aideen's dad is the famous Paddy Maloney, who was the front man, if you will, of the Chieftains. So tell me a little bit about your experience growing up in Dublin. It obviously had to be a different household because of your dad, right? Kind of a public man.
Yeah, well, first of all, my father was a very young man, still a young man when I was born, and young in his career as well. And so I had a mix of an environment and of a childhood. Primarily, it was a very happy childhood with mommy and daddy. And I loved my parents very, very much. I still do. And so I had a very sort of, I'd like to think, ordinary or normal upbringing. I went to the equivalent of a public school, St. Anne's National and Secondary School in Milltown. And it was all girls and all from all walks of life, but mostly just pretty normal and simple way of life. And I didn't grow up privileged, contrary to maybe, I suspect, popular belief. I don't know. I grew up in very humble beginnings. It was rich in art and music and culture. And my father and my mother were both ahead of the game, forward thinking, ahead of with their work, with their art. And so obviously I was very privileged and very honored to have had my father as my father. But it, at the same time, and I got to meet a lot of like very interesting people. I didn't know who they were, but they were interesting. And but at the same time, I had a very stable and normal traditional Irish upbringing. And my parents worked very hard to create that and to keep that there for us as children. I grew up in, my mother had grown up with her grandmother and her step-grandfather, Pat O'Neill, who owned a small little house that was a shop in Milltown. We had no bathtub or shower until I was 10 or 11. We had a sink to wash in, just like a typical blue-collar Dublin city terraced house. You know, there was a small backyard, concrete backyard, and a lavatory down the end in a little outhouse. And not unlike, I might add, for those of your viewers who are not familiar with Dublin and Ireland, that film Belfast, the houses, is something similar to that. And so that's how I grew up. And Mammy used to, when Daddy was away, she didn't drive. We'd take the bus or walk to Ranelagh, which is about a mile and a half away every day, to go to the shop, the local grocery store and the local butchers, and to get our dinner, you know, and fishmonger. And very simple life. And I grew up, you know, the chieftains were actually formed in the house. And we had one room downstairs that was dining, living room, everything all together. And there was a small little scullery. So I certainly grew up spent right up until my teenage years in very sort of simple and humble beginnings, but extremely privileged on all other levels, and being exposed to the arts and, you know, traditional Irish art and most especially to the genius that was and is my father.
I've heard that you grew up without a TV. So that kind of, I would think, syncs up with the modest home life, right? But looking back at it now, was that a good or a bad thing?
Oh, no, it was great. We had a television from when I was about, I'd say, 12 onwards. But we used to have only just RTE1 and RTE2, two channels, you know. But I used to go and stay with my grandparents, my mother's parents, up in Stepaside in Dublin on the weekends. And they had a television. So as my grandfather would say, you get a feed a telly. Go in there now and get a feed a telly. So not every weekend, but no, I didn't miss it. Because we entertained, you know, what you don't know, you don't miss. To be honest with you, I didn't miss it. I mean, as I said, we were avid readers as children, and we made up little games and created little plays, and we learned songs, and not Irish songs per se. We were listening to, you know, The Who and any records Daddy brought home from his colleagues. So, you know, I didn't miss the television, quite honestly. You know, my father used to bring home a lot of records and albums from whenever he was away. He started traveling sort of, I think, extensively in sort of 1975, 74, 75, around that time, and to London and places like that. And he would have a lot of friends who were in all walks of life, all walks of genres of music. And he'd bring home their records and we'd play them, my brother and I. And we'd learn every word of every song. And then my dad would have to come home and we'd have to perform them all. So we were like performing The Who and The Rolling Stones. And oh my God, it was so much fun. My poor mom and dad, they had to sit through hours of concerts.
Not exactly traditional Irish, but one of our other guests had a connection with your dad, a lady called Katie Coleman.
I love Katie.
An astronaut. Yeah. And she kind of referred to the fact that your father would visit, I think, down in Houston, I believe, where your brother was interning in NASA. Yeah. So it's kind of funny, these very small, tight networks and crossovers kind of cool.
Oh yeah, you know? That's a really good crossover, that one. You know, just to give you a little background, my father, before he went professional, I mean, he was always a musician, from a genius from a very young age, and you all know his history and his background from his childhood. But He also was an accountant or a bookkeeper at Baxendale's, which was a hardware store in Dublin. And that was where he worked. And that's where he met my mother, as it so happened. But also, I should say that my father was a numerical genius. He could look at a series of numbers that could be like, you know, random numbers that could be wildly long. And he had a photographic memory for them. Hmm. So it actually makes sense that two of his sons are mathematical geniuses. So my older brother, Angus, seems to be doing a master's every year on how to teach maths to maths teachers. But my younger brother, my baby brother, was the first ever Irish undergraduate at MIT to get into MIT. And from there, he was, I believe he was, he got an internship at NASA. I mean, very smart young man. And he got an internship at NASA, which led him to a full-time job there. And as a rocket scientist, nanoscale physicist, aerospace engineer. And he went on then, you know, he worked his way up through NASA, and he was actually the first ever, the first ever non-green card holder to get a green card and, you know, be accepted. You know, it took many years through NASA. And he was designing parts of the rockets going up into space. And I'm like, what? And then he went on and he became a nanoscale physicist. He had got his doctorate in nanoscale. But so he is the one who connected Katie Coleman with my father, not vice versa. So it's a wonderful story. You just never know. And Katie, of course, was a musician, like, you know, played at home as well, had been, you know, listening to the Chieftains and to my father's music for most of her life. So the rest is history.
She told us that she had an astronaut. The astronauts had a band and they would like open for the Chieftains.
Yeah.
And she would play with Patty. And he said, you know, you get up there and play, and we'll be playing together.
Yeah.
And then don't step back. You know, we're doing this together. So the two of them would start to play, and instinctively she'd drift to the background, and he would just stop playing until she came back up and played with him.
I was at a couple of Chieftains concerts, and I'm sure I was privileged, and I'm sure there are many, many of your listeners who can say the same, where they had a live feed with her and she'd be playing with the Chieftains at a Chieftains, a live free feed from outer space.
From the space station.
I know. Yeah. I mean, is that not amazing? Bless his heart. My dad was always ahead of the game, always, because he had a pure soul and he didn't copy, and he had a pure creative genius. It came from a very profound and, you know, I like to say divine place. And he was very open to us. And so, you know, that was one of his many, many, many achievements.
Can I ask the question? I imagine it can't be easy to be the daughter of a famous man like that. It could be challenging, you know, as you try to carve out your own space in the world. So how did that play for you?
Well, there was positive and negative. But I'd like to think that there is positive and negative for everybody, you know, with I guess mine is uniquely my own experience. I found it difficult in that most people didn't really care, or, you know, have accepted me as who I am and what I bring to the world. And what I do is, you know, and I do very well, is act. And I've been doing it for many, many years. And I don't do much else in life very well, but certainly when it comes to acting, I'm very confident in it. However, I have found over the years there people who don't know me, most people who know me know exactly who I am and what it's like and what it's like being Aideen and Aideen Maloney. But I have found there are a few people, and always people who don't know me at all or know me very little, have assumptions, you know, that, oh, privileged life, privileged background. No, not at all. My father raised us to be independent. If you're going to make it in whatever you do in life, you do it. You do it by yourself. You have that sense of achievement and you create and carve out your own life and your own career, and you are not beholden to anyone, and including your parents. And that has certainly stood to me. But there is that misconception that that's not the case. And I have the same struggles as every unemployed person. I'm looking for ways to pay the rent. I'm looking for ways to put food on the table. How am I going to, okay, well, I won't buy some product or other until I find the next job, or I save and I economize, just like every person who is in my wage bracket, which is pretty low, compared, you know, which is the case for most actors in this world. So I guess that annoys me sometimes, that people, some people, not everybody, as I said, like a small minority, would think that, you know, and assume that. Or, I remember one time many years ago, somebody who was in a position to allow me to have an audition many, many years ago, not here, not in America, in another country. And I remember them saying to me, you'll be all right. You're Paddy Maloney's daughter. And that really, to learn that at a younger age was quite disheartening. And I guess, you know, I'll never forget it, because it was the first time something like that happened. And I was like, but what do you mean? I have to audition just like everybody else, you know? So I have experienced a little bit of that, and I'm not feeling sorry for myself by any means, but it has come against me at times. Yes.
Let's talk about the life you chose in terms of the theater. Very difficult profession, very challenging, at times very rewarding, at times very frustrating. What were your, we have a sense of how you entered the theater through your, you know, as a child, acting out the Ulysses and making up plays with your siblings and friends. But what were some of the more formal steps you took towards becoming an actor, a theater person?
Well, I guess at the beginning, you know, when I was still in high school, actually, I'll tell you how it really kicked off was I was 13 years of age, and there was a drama school, the only drama school in Dublin that at that time, I don't want to give away my age now, but was called the Oscar Theatre Acting School. And it was a weekend school that was founded and run by a lovely man now who's passed on, is Chris O'Neill, and a lovely actor, and his brother Vincent O'Neill, who's also based here in America. And so I wanted to be a part of this, but it was for adults. So I never thought that would get in the way. So I set up an audition. I was 13, and they were holding their annual auditions. And my audition piece was Estelle from Jean-Paul Sartre's In Camera, which was really not suitable for a 13-year-old at all, but I was ambitious. And they were so blown away, or just so, what is this person? They said, no, we can't take you in. But why don't you come back when you're 16 or four? I came back the next year. They let me in. But so I grew up in that environment, which was Dublin in the 80s, with all of these wonderful actors who were a great deal older than I was, but and great characters, and it was a different world, and it was a very inclusive, and I found it to be very inclusive and very caring environment. I was fortunate enough to to work with these people. So at the time, there was a thing called the fit-ups, which were for secondary schools, you know, depending on what Shakespeare play was on for the Leaving Cert. There were touring groups that went around the schools in Ireland and got paid pittance, but to perform the play in the schools. And I auditioned while I was in the Oscar. I auditioned for Peter Sheridan. Jim Sheridan's brother, the amazing Peter Sheridan, was directing the Scottish play. And I auditioned, and I auditioned for all the little boys because, you know, I've always been small. And, you know, back then I had shorter hair or tied it up or whatever I did. But another thing that I did was I fenced. I like to fence. So I got cast. And that was like a baptism of fire into the professional world. And Jesus, these people really took good care of me and had my back and watched out for me. And, you know, I was on the road with them. And then I finished secondary school and I failed maths in the Leaving Cert. Could never, unlike my father and my math genius brothers, I don't understand why X has to be anything other than X. So, I don't know, maybe I just didn't have a good teacher, who knows? But I was very smart on all of the subjects, but to get into university in Ireland, you have to pass, you know, maths. You know, especially back in those days, Martin will tell you that now. And but I got into Trinity College in their theatre studies program. I auditioned and I was also a visual artist. So I had a portfolio that I presented of design that, you know, I still dabble in the art as well a little bit. So, and I got in, and I did 2 years at Trinity, a diploma in theatre studies. And so that was another major stepping stone. And at the same time, then in 1989, I got cast as Mulzer in Plough in the Stars, directed by Joe Dowling at the Gaiety Theatre. And that was when, you know, ran for a year. And that was in 1989. That was a major production with the late Donald McCann and Rosalind Lenihan and the late Anita Reeves. And, oh, just a wonderful cast. And, again, I was taken under the wing by these luminaries of Irish theatre. I was very lucky. And then after that, then, you know, I left Ireland because I couldn't get a job. I couldn't get seen, couldn't get an audition for anything, for love nor money. And so off I went to London and I started building a television career in London at that time.
So how was it being an Irish actress in London?
Well, I found it pretty amazing. I think the timing was perfect. I didn't realize it at the time. I was only a young girl and I mean, you can't have regrets in life. I probably should have stuck it out a little longer before coming to America. But, you know, I was getting roles and, you know, there were roles that no one really cared that I was Irish, or television roles. No one cared I was Irish and they were good roles. And for a young girl starting out, I was doing pretty well. And this was in the 90s. And, you know, obviously it was the early 90s and through to the late 90s. And obviously there was some political turmoil going on at the time in London, but, you know, when is there not? And I really should have, you know, being Irish on one level, you know, they were changing times for Irish people in London. And, you know, I was young and... I want to go to New York, you know, and I had a different life and a different type of career, you know, coming here to New York. But certainly London, in hindsight, oh, it was good, you know, and I might go back there. I've been invited back a couple of times. I might go back again soon, you know, with the project.
So talk to us about what triggered the move to New York. from London, I guess, I assume from London.
Yes. Well, it was, again, the early 90s, and it was the era of the Donnelly visas, you know, the lottery visas, lottery green cards. And my mammy thought, oh, I'm going to apply for my child. So she put out the application. She got me to sign it, put in an application for me. We never thought we'd hear any more. Darned it if I didn't get one. So that's why I came to America, literally. And then first thing I did, I knew nobody. And I had done an interview for the press in London. And the photographer who took my pictures for the newspaper at the time was a relative of a woman called Mary Tierney, who became like an adoptive parent to me here, a foster parent here in New York. I knew nobody. And, you know, like many people before me, including Jim Sheridan, I believe, stayed in her apartment, slept on her floor when we arrived. And she took great care of me, you know, as a young girl when I was still young. I was in my late 20s by then. And that's young. And when I came to New York. And while I was here, she said, you know what, they're auditioning up at the Irish Arts Centre for, I can't remember the play. It was in 1994, but you should go and audition. And I said, but it's probably cast. And, you know, they're equity auditions, the open auditions. And I went, I just showed up and yeah, it was cast. It was pre-cast. But Nye Heron, the gentleman who was head of the Irish Arts Centre back then, said, you are amazing. I'm producing a play next year, a two-hander called Bar and Jer by Geraldine Aron. And I want you to play Jer, which is Geraldine Aron. And I said, yes, please. And, you know, it was an off-Broadway contract. So it would be my, you know, I was very lucky. And you know, I was invited back for the auditions. They were auditioning boys to play my brother and in the two-hander. And they said, look, you're cast, but we'd like you to sit in on the auditions and see how you feel about all these young men, that young boys who are coming to audition. And there were some tremendous actors, some tremendous young Irish and non-Irish actors came and auditioned. And then there was one that came in the middle, a tall, lanky fella called John Keating, who had never, I think he'd done one play, non-equity, you know, semi, you know, off Broadway play. And he just not only stood tall, you know, but he just, he stood out. And I said, you know what, he's the one. And so he was cast. And so we both got our equity cards on the same show. We became best friends. And here we are now, all these years later, still working together. And he's directed this latest production of Yes, Reflections of Molly Bloom at the Irish Rep. And so that's how I got here.
Well, you seem to take us up to the current production very well there, Aideen. It sounds like you've been living with Molly in a way for many years, since age 10. But also, I mean, I've heard you perform pieces of Molly's Soliloquy several times over the last few years. What was the process that went from your interest in that piece of writing into the production we have today?
So I have been working on for 20 years. It's nothing new. I started adapting the script way back in 2004. I punctuated the entire monologue, understood it. It just flowed right through me, and I could see it unraveled before my eyes like a puzzle. And I knew what Joyce was after. I knew my mother, I knew my grandmother, I knew my great-grandmother. I knew every woman that I had ever come in contact with. And I saw a piece of all of them, and I had such a deep love, just a passion and a love for that character, because my love for that character is like all the love I feel for all those women who are very dear to me. and over the years. And I feel I owe it to them. I don't know why I'm driven for it to, it's like something else working through me. And I know that sounds a bit weird, but I really do feel that. And so 20 years ago, my good friend and renowned author, Colin McCann, invited me to Stone Street, to Ulysses Bar on Stone Street here in New York, to a new Bloomsday event that he was starting back then. And he said, come and just read a bit of Molly. And I said, but I'm not Molly Bloom. You know, I mean, of course I am. But at the time, you know, I thought of all of those great women who have gone before me and still continue to read and, you know, allow Molly to live within their hearts. And but I saw her as something completely different. And you know, I do know that my interpretation and my adaptation are unique and unique to me. And you know, I just didn't have the confidence back then. And so with his encouragement and his support, with Colm's encouragement and support, I came down and I read it. And if it was indoors, I would have said blew the roof off, but it's outdoors. And people have continued to come back since. I'm sort of like their resident Molly Bloom every Bloomsday. So at the same time, Colm said, now, Aideen, you need to get this together. You need to adapt this for the stage. You are Molly Bloom. And he's for 20 years, he's been saying it to me. So I started working on it back then. And I started working, I wanted to do a full audio recording of the entire monologue, which I did in 2016. So I started working with my father in 2014. When we had never worked together. And I said, look, I want you to help me with some music, because Molly's soliloquy is made up of a handful of seven sentences. You know, there's no punctuation, you know. So, and I do believe that everything that Joyce does is very precise, and there's no mistakes and at all. And so there's a reason for everything. And for me, I felt like it was when she drifted off. And what happens when we drift off into sleep? You know, she's sleepy and she drifts off into sleep. Our dreams, our subconscious come into play. They take over. And so what is her subconscious? Her subconscious is what she doesn't know, what she's seeking, which is her maternal line is, you know, it's all everything that's talking to her and whispering to her. And, you know, she's reaching out for through the ages and journeying back into to find it and fuse with it again, to find purpose in life. And I also believe that Molly Bloom is the symbol of life, of Mother Earth, the final yes being an affirmation of yes, I choose life. Because even in our last breath, we are gasping for breath. We are saying, yes, I'm trying to live. So this is what I wanted to do. And I wanted to take her out of the bed, and because it is in her mind. Why not have her live in her mind as she sees herself and not in a bed? So I did. And so my father created this beautiful music for that rested or gently, you know, gave us a breath between each sentence in the audio version. And then I started putting together the script for, you know, editing it for the play. And I had a draft of it going back to, you know, 2008, a finished draft. And I had, you know, sent it, I think, in about 2012, I think, to the Irish Rep. And it just was never the right time. And then in 2019, I said, Colm, you know, you're my mentor, you know, and, you know, you've told me to do this madness. And will you take a look at what I've done? And he was like overwhelmed, you know, he was incredibly supportive of me and said, this is brilliant, you know, you're a genius. And I was like, no, I'm not. But so then he stepped in and he helped me, you know, he partnered with me, pointing out things that were not working, you know, and I'm like, oh no, they're not, that is, you know, that you're right. You know, for example, how does an audience member know who to clarify who she's talking about? So, so what he has done, and so it's so simple and so genius at the same time. He would put in phrases like that made complete sense, like Mulvey, Mulvey, Mulvey. You know, so like, you know, Molly says, obviously, you know, not in Bloom's text, but, you know, we're not using anyone else's words. We're using his words. And of course, it's genius, you know, and he knew what I was after. And so, and poldy, woldy doodle and stuff like this, you know, just really beautiful and very subtle. And I know you guys have never seen the actual script itself, but his stage directions are so poetic and just musical within themselves and quite simple, very subtle. And, you know, and I had put in the music where I wanted the music to go. And so anyway, the Irish Rep picked it up. I had a wonderful director called Kira Simmering, a young woman called Kira Simmering on the first production. And, you know, as an actor, you respect what a director brings to the table. And she chose not to use the music. She used the music as an intro and an ending of the piece. And which, you know, it was a lovely production in itself. And then, and it was lovely working with a woman, you know, on this for the first time. And she gave me a great deal of encouragement and space to develop my style with my Isadora Duncan-ish, you know, movement and use of fabric. And the fabric is the symbol of, you know, for me anyway, I know if no one else gets it, it's actually, it's a symbol of earth, of like water, of flow, of life, of Ireland. It is, you know, and that's why, how I use that. So I started using that way back then. And then I did an audio. I was supposed to come back and do it at the Rep. Won all the awards, the theatre awards and accolades and whatnot. And the wonderful Irish Rep invited me back again to do it in 2020. And then the pandemic hit. And then they asked me to do a virtual performance of it on my phone from, I was stuck in Miami with my partner, Arnie. And I just didn't want to just set it up on a tripod and just say the words. I said, no, I've got to reenact this. I got to bring the physical movement into it. So my dance teacher, choreographer down in a salsa choreographer down in Miami, Fernando Garcia, I said, Fernando, I have no one to shoot this. I don't know anyone down here. We don't have time to rehearse it. We have 3 hours. Do you mind just following me with my iPhone? And that's what we did. And, you know, it was magic. And there was no rehearsals. There was no choreography. It was just following me around this room in an apartment that somebody lent me. And it worked. And then the lovely Irish Rep invited me back again this year to perform live and 2022. And I also performed it at the Centre Culturel Irlandais in Paris. They invited me there and that was very special. So here we are. And I've talked too much.
No. And I was at that performance you did at the Stones, Stone Street. And I remember that's the only thing I remember from the evening.
Oh, thank you.
So, Marty, do you have one?
Yeah. Can I ask, there's not many one-person shows out there. So talk to us a little bit about occupying a stage for 90 minutes and filling up that space as you very capably do, despite your diminutive status, size compared to me at least. Can you tell us how that differs from more ensemble acting? How do you
well,
get ready?
Yeah, well, first of all, I always believe that I have a very huge presence on stage, and I know I do. And, you know, I don't look a small in any role I've ever done. I'm always playing characters that are quite tall. And I don't know why, but, and then, you know, people say, Jesus, everyone says, Jesus, you're so small. When they see me afterwards, you know, and I'm like, you know, as I said to you, like, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn. I've not been very successful in many things in life, but the one thing I've thrown myself into, I don't have children. I don't, you know, a pet. Her, you know, I live for what I do, my craft or my art, like how my daddy did with his. And maybe I inherit that from him, is the largeness, or how you must, like with a can opener, open your chest open and let it all out, fly out of you. And, you know, every pore of your being must be alive. And that's how I approach my work. And so I'm off to a head start with one person shows, in that, you know, I'm probably a bit larger than life. And so when I have an extraordinary amount of energy, not as much as my father did, but I still have, I've inherited a great deal of that drive from him, that the performance, what is needed for a performance. And I believe in not just standing on a stage, and you know, I believe in literally finding my way out through, you know, I meditate and allowing my energy to weave its way out into an audience and literally into their heart. I try to go into their, I visualize entering their ear and their hearts. And that's with the energy level. And I think that's really important. So 90 minutes with the stream of consciousness monologue that's on its feet is like a marathon. It's absolutely devastating by the end and exhausting by the end. It is an athletic feat of the imagination and vocally, and finding the breath and the music, because it, as you've seen, it's dance and it's music, so it's everything, and it has to be everything for it to work. You can't sit back on your laurels and allow the energy to sag, because if I do that, I feel it just drain out of the room, like down the drain. And you know, you will lose an audience member, if not all of them. So it's very important to you know, to have it. You know, I try to eat well and sleep well, and that's not always, you know, a good thing with me. I don't sleep so good, but you know, I think it's important. So I hope I've answered that question.
Yeah, I think so. I think to some degree what you're saying, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're actually not alone on the stage, because you're yeah, embracing the audience in a way. And yeah, I did feel that sitting in the audience last week, that kind of like you were talking right to me, you know.
Yeah, but you have to. I mean, the thing is, like, yes, she's on her own, and yes, she's talking to herself, and she's living it within herself. But the relationship between, no matter, you know, what so many actors and directors will say, just ignore the audience, just do it for you. Just, it's all about, you know, that's not necessarily true. And the only time that worked for me was when I was alone doing the virtual, the last 20 minutes I shot alone. And I think that's why it worked so well, is like I wasn't performing for anybody, and I could do it for myself, and pure from my heart, as a gift of love to myself. But to be honest with you, I don't care what anybody says. God, I sound like Molly Bloom now. She says that too. I don't care what anybody says, but the relationship between an audience and an actor is evident for every actor. And they might pretend that it isn't, but it is really important. And to maintain that, And, you know, I never feel it so much in an ensemble piece or, you know, a two-hander. If there's someone else up on stage with me, I have that person to play to. And my job is to give everything to them so as to affect change in them, you know, and to prompt their next line or to prompt their next action, their role. My job is to serve. And that is, you know, that is about being generous. You have to be completely generous in multi-person plays. But with a monologue, you know, the only people you have are the audience. And so it's very difficult to switch off sensitivity. You know, let's say someone's sitting in the front row and you know how intimate it is in that theater and they are restless or they, you know, they decide to get a candy out of their bag or put their feet up on the stage. You know, I feel like saying, I effing can see you and hear you, you know, but I can't do that, you know.
Well, I think Molly might have done that.
She might have. I have to tell you, though, there was, you know, it's only happened to me once in the front row on this run. Some poor lady, God love her. You know, she had obviously didn't know how to turn off her phone and it went off, you know, and oh, she didn't know where it was and she couldn't turn it off and she had to get up and leave from the front row. And it's a tiny little, you know, as you know, it's really intimate. Yeah. The audience and me are intimate with each other and oh my God, love her. And I felt really bad for her. She must have been terribly embarrassed, but I did have to stop.
Mm.
You know, because it was at a quiet moment and I had to say, listen, are there any more phones? Please turn them off. You know, I've never done that.
Oh, dear. So, you know, live theater, anything can happen. Any other incidents from your experience where things just didn't quite go right on the stage?
Oh, God, there's so many of them. And they usually make me laugh, especially I usually corpse. Like, and have a hard time getting back into it, quite honestly, because I love when stuff goes wrong. I really do. I like it. There was one time, there's so many stories, but another time on the first production of Yes, Reflections of Molly Bloom in 2019, I was, you know, there was one gentleman who had an umbrella and he had laid it down on the stage and he was told to take it off. You know, the house manager had said, look, do you mind, you know, he put it back up, you know, and somebody had left, you know, all their programs, you know, like their playbills. So at one stage I just picked it up and started reading. What am I supposed to do? And handed it to them because, you know, there was a moment where I was supposed to, you know, where my blocking was and I was supposed to stand right there and I couldn't, I'd fall. So, but this new production directed by John Keating, John has allowed me to take my body movement, you know, to where I really wanted to go with it and encouraged it and supported that. And my choreography and has helped me find more stillness. You know, I don't move as much or bounce off the walls as much. And it's lovely. It's a production for the ages. And he also, and I kiss his feet for this. He has finally, my father's music has started to be introduced into the text where it belongs. And where it was composed and arranged and recorded for. And there's still room for some more, but gosh, he's done it beautifully and got the ball rolling on that. So he's a dream to work with.
Aideen, really want to thank you here. You're leaving us at the point in the production where we'd like to give you a chance to promote something, which we call the Seamus plug. And you're kind of leading into it, I think, when you're talking about that this performance of this play, Yes, Reflections of Molly Bloom, is one for the ages. It's about when we're recording this episode, you've got about 7 more performances left at the Irish Rep. Where will people see it next?
Ooh, Well, so what I'm working on at the moment is a feature film. I am going to film this on location. I'm not going to say where because it's a secret right now. And but we're in the process of like early stages of putting a production team together to make that happen. And that will be shot within probably this time next year, maybe early autumn, fall. And so that's in the works. I'm very excited about that. I spent the pandemic teaching myself how to edit film. And because I know what I would like and how I would like it shaped. So having, you know, a head start on that and knowing what I'm after was important. So I made use of my time during the pandemic. There's also talk of it being brought to Ireland. And so watch this space. And you will find more information on the website wildmountainflower.com, which is the production company, and also on my personal website, adinemaloney.com. I've also been invited a couple of places here in the US. So those are in the works at the moment as well. And more.
I'm sure any investor would be welcome for any of these projects.
Absolutely. Money's money. Money talks. The arts needs money. And, you know, yes, Reflections of Molly Bloom is no different. Yep. So, yes.
So with that, we'd like to thank you, Adine, for giving us a view into what it's like to be a working actor, especially a unique type of actor that does one-person shows, because that calls for some extraordinary talent. And for those that haven't seen, yes, Reflections of Molly Bloom, if you do get a chance going forward, wherever the production crops up, I strongly recommend it. And so thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adine.
What a delight.
Hey, John, I really enjoyed that chat with my fellow Dubliner, Adine Maloney. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on listening to Adine's life story.
Yeah, it was great to get that perspective from her. I've known her for a bit, but just to get the inner workings of her mind when she's creating a character, when she's putting on a production. And I have to say, Martin, you and I have kind of struggled to make our way through Ulysses, and she was reading it at age 10, and she's still exploring the book in her one-woman show, Yes, Reflections of Molly Bloom.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important takeaways from that, and it's somewhat similar to the other guests that we've had on here talking about Ulysses, is one of the best ways to actually absorb the novel is to just read it out loud and let it flow over you. Do not bring any preconceived notions to it. Don't chase down any rabbit holes by trying to figure out some obscure reference. But I'm delighted that in addition to spending 1 hour of her time with us, Adine was kind enough to record the Mulvey section of her one-woman show. And so without further ado, here is Adine with an extract from Yes, Reflections of Molly Bloom.
I wish somebody would write me a love letter. True or no? It fills up your whole day and life. Always something to think about and see it all around you like a new world. Mulvey's was the first. Gibraltar. An admirer, he signed it. I near jumped out of my skin. I wanted to pick him up when I saw him following me along the Calle Real in the shop window. Then he tipped me just in passing. But I never thought he would write making an appointment. I had it inside my petticoat bodice all day, reading it up in every hole and corner. Shall I wear a white rose? and I wanted to put on the stupid old clock to near the time. He was the first man kissed me under the Moorish wall. My sweetheart, when a boy, it never entered my head what kissing meant. His mouth was sweet like yum. I put my knee up to him a few times just to learn the way. Oh, what did I tell him I was engaged for? Fun to the son of a nobleman named Don Miguel de la Flora. And he believed we were to be married in 3 years' time. Well, there's many a true word spoken in jest. I got him excited. Moppy. When he crushed all the flowers on my bosom, he brought me Capoquin. He came from, he said, on the black water. But it was too short. Molly, darling, he called me. Yeah, my mother, whoever she was, might have given me a nicer name, the Lord knows, after the lovely one she had. Lunita Laredo. What's this his other name was? Jack, Joe, Harry. Harry Mulvey, yes, a lieutenant he was, rather fair with a laughing kind of a voice. Mustache, Eddie. Then the day before he left, May, yes, it was May when the infant king of Spain was born, up on the tip-top under the rock on near O'Hara's tower. He was looking at me. Oh. We lay over the Fear Tree Cove, a wild place. The ships out far like chips. That was the Malta boat passing. Oh, and the sea and the sky. He wanted to touch mine with his for a moment, but I wouldn't let him for fear. You never know. And but I said that. How did we finish it off? Yes. Oh, yes. Pretending not to be excited, but oh, I opened my legs. Murphy, oh, I wouldn't let him touch me inside of my petticoat. I tortured the life out of him, first tickling him, his eyes shut. Russ, the walk, 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 walk. He was shy. All the same, I liked him. I was a bit wild after coming back by the Jews' burial place, pretending to read out the Hebrew on them. I wanted to fire his pistol. He said he hadn't one. He didn't know what to make of me. With his peaked cap on that he always wore crooked as often as I settled it straight. HMS Calypso. He said he'd come back. Perhaps he's dead, or killed, or a captain, or an admiral. Perhaps he's married some girl off the black water and is quite changed. They all do. They haven't half the character a woman has. I went up Windmill Hill to the flats that Sunday morning. I wore the frock from the Beaumarchais Paris. The straits shining, I could see over to Morocco, almost to the Bay of Tangier. White the Atlas mountains with snow on them, and the straits like a river so clear. He went to India. He was to write. Molly, darling, Harry, I can see his face, clean shaven.
Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Kahlo Reardon on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.